It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2017, more than 25,000 children from birth to age 20 spent some time in foster care. The number is fluid because of successful efforts to reunify children with their birth families or relatives. As we wrap up Foster Care Awareness Month, we're going to discuss the challenges that some agencies face in finding suitable homes with healthy environments for Pennsylvania kids. Jackie Hoover is the Deputy Director of Children, Youth, and Families for Allegheny County. Jackie, welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning. Thank you.
Jackie, let's start with how many kids are in foster care in Allegheny County?
In Allegheny County, we have 1,468.
Okay. Has that number changed much, say, in the last 5-10 years?
Sure. So that has been an increase. We're slowly scheming down a little bit from the beginning of this year, where we had about 1,500. We saw an increase in the last 2 years, primarily, we believe, due to the opioid crisis, and has caused us to really be out there and recruiting for more appropriate homes. I would say about 64-65% of all of our children in care are placed with a relative, but we still need appropriate resources that might not be a relative.
So the opioid crisis that has affected so many aspects of our society has impacted you, your work, and most importantly, kids.
Sure, absolutely. I think we've seen close to a 20% increase in our referrals, and those referrals primarily have allegations of a substance use disorder.
There's a reason why these children need foster care. Maybe they're neglected, possibly abused. How difficult is it to find foster families for these children who are having to deal with the effects of not receiving normal care?
Right. Well, I always say parenting is hard in general. People just fail to realize just how challenging it is to raise a child, let alone to welcome a child into your home and raise them and love them and support them, as well as supporting their natural family as well. So it is a challenge to be a foster parent. However, my understanding from those that I work with daily is that the challenges, you know, greatly are outweighed by what is offered back. You know, to see a child thriving and, you know, really growing and being nurtured in your home, I would think is the most valuable reward you could have.
It's often been said about adoption, it's easier to find adoptive families for babies than older kids. Does the same hold true for foster kids?
Yes. So we've had a couple initiatives within the county, primarily looking at teen foster homes. So we had an initiative about 3 years ago where we had a higher number than we were comfortable with of young people placed in congregate care settings. So
what do you mean by congregate
care? Like a group home, mm-hmm. Where they would live in together, which is not how you grew up living. So we made a referral for proposals out to all of our providers asking, could they recruit in a different way families who were willing to take in older youth and teens and support them how you would your own young adult thriving into the transition into adulthood. And we have 4 providers who do that. However, it's a challenge. If you've ever raised a teenager, it is a daily struggle with all that they're going to, given today's challenges, as you know, we continue to have more technology and our youth are dealing with things that we've not ever been accustomed to dealing with. We have to be prepared to help foster families deal with those struggles. And so we have the 4 providers, and you know, we are constantly out recruiting more for those teen homes. Can you not just take a youth into your home, but can you give a connection? Can you help mentor? Can you maybe take on a college tour or look at a trade? Offer some level of advice or connection to somebody. We believe everybody should have a mentor or a connection to somebody that can be supportive through their transition into adulthood.
According to Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children's State of the Child Welfare Report, the number of children entering foster care as infants is on the rise in the state. Is that true of the county as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
So again, I hate to blame the opioid crisis, but you know, we saw an increase in the number of youth, or babies rather, coming into care placed under one. A number of those are referred at birth, being exposed to a substance use. I would say that most of our cases and referrals do not come in to foster care. Of the, you know, over 15,000 calls we get, and you can see we only have a little over 1,400 youth in care. Primarily, we offer supportive services and we keep the children in the homes until we cannot appropriately say that they're safe and the court has to intervene. More than half, I think, right, are under one.
Right. Well, is that particularly concerning? Because the littlest ones, I mean, they're the most dependent on good adult care.
Sure. And those are the ones that we find most vulnerable and that we believe are most in need of safe care. They can't tell us what's going on. So, you know, those are the ones that we have to put the most planning in, and that those are the ones that are probably at greatest risk of removal.
Give us an idea how the interruption in caregiving impacts infants and toddlers as far as their development.
Sure. So developmentally, you know, the first 3 months of life is when, you know, I won't get too much into the brain development, right, but when children are not thriving, not nurtured, or being exposed, you know, they can cause a failure to thrive that greatly impacts the brain development and into adulthood, and it can stunt the learning and development where they might not be able to grow or develop their brain naturally.
And even their emotions and behaviors?
Correct. You know, and that early exposure to trauma, be it whether you can remember it or not, has long-lasting effects.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the state of foster care locally and in the state with Jackie Hoover, Deputy Director of Children, Youth, and Families for Allegheny County. Jackie, can children live so-called a normal life while they're in foster care?
Absolutely. I would hope that most of our children in foster care, like I said, most of them are with a relative. However, the ones that are not, I would say, have the same level of normalcy as any other child. Some children might not even know that they're directly in foster care. They know that they're not living with their parent because a parent might not be safe, but they might refer to a foster parent as, you know, another type of loving name. And, you know, there are normalcy standards that were set out by the state of Pennsylvania, which all child welfare agencies have to make sure we're in compliance with.
You mentioned relatives. Is that kinship care?
Correct. And when we say kinship care, we don't necessarily term kin as a blood relative. Kinship care, we have placed young people with teachers, police officers, librarians, anybody who's been a support within their life, your best friend's child. You think about somebody that you care for and that you would be willing to take in your home and support until they're able to go home safely.
Mm-hmm. Are the children who have already been negatively affected in some way due to not the level of care that they should get vulnerable in other ways, vulnerable to abuse or being taken advantage of?
Sure.
Or what? How so?
So because you have been exposed to a level of trauma, some children, especially older children, are more at risk for other safety factors. So young people who are in foster care are more at risk of being commercially and sexually exploited, more at risk for more behavioral health needs, just because of untreated trauma and, you know, good connections. So that's really why, you know, we're really out there recruiting, looking for people who can provide a positive connection for a young person, who can provide some nurturing, some supportive words or just advice.
Are there steps being taken to, you know, protect these vulnerable kids from abuse, exploitation, what have you?
Yes. So in the county, we have several interventions. We also have private investigators where, you know, if we feel that youth are experiencing unsafe behavior while they're running away, that we would do what any parent would do. We would go and do all an all-out search, try to find them. We also have a drop-in center for youth who are at risk or currently being trafficked. We have many in-home services. We have life skills. We have a what we refer to as Youth Villages Life Set. We have mobile crisis teams. We do all that we can to connect young people with the emergency crisis services to help, you know, mitigate some of the factors that may put them more at risk.
Foster care, it's not meant to be permanent, obviously. Your goal is timely reunification, if possible, with biological families. Briefly, what are the conditions for reunification?
Well, so I guess I should just say, as of last year, of all the children that were in care, about 56% of those were reunified, and around 35% were either adopted or entered into some subsidized permanent legal custodianship. So, you know, 35% found a permanent home that might have been outside of their parents. But we, you know, the law dictates that once a child is in an out-of-home placement, 15 out of the last 22 months, we have got to start a more permanent option for them. So we try to do concurrent planning where we're working on reunification as well as trying to find that permanent home. We really work hard on finding that permanent home be the first placement so that foster parents have the opportunity to continue to support and advocate for that child.
In a sentence, what could Pennsylvanians be doing better to better serve its most vulnerable kids?
So I would say if people could look at what is needed, and you can go to fostergoodness.org, and we have many videos that show what a day in the life of a youth is and what is needed and what might be expected of a foster parent. That shows the challenges as well as the benefits. And if anyone is interested, if you take a look at that, and then you would find out what's necessary to need.
Jackie Hoover is the Deputy Director of Children, Youth, and Families for Allegheny County. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A turtle commonly kept as a pet is wreaking havoc on Lake Erie's Presque Isle. These red-eared sliders are sometimes released by pet owners who no longer want them, but they've become an invasive species, living for 30 years and taking resources from other native animals. A new project seeks to reduce the population of these turtles. And a new initiative called Street Stages offers designated spots for street performers in Pittsburgh. These buskers will be able to show off their skills at stenciled stages on sidewalks in downtown, the Strip District, Lawrenceville, and Millvale starting Friday. Find more at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This month, most of the city's iconic water features gushed to life for the first time this year. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley visits Pittsburgh's fountains, old and new.
In North Park, near a small shallow creek off of Cummer Road, there's a structure that looks like it's straight out of a sci-fi story, like Lord of the Rings. Built into the side of a mound off the road is a building with a dark portal in the center. The rocks that make up the formation are covered in moss and starting to turn green.
From the outside, you can see just like it's into the hillside. There's a stone arch that literally says Fountain of Youth on it.
Listener Ben Mull grew up in Pittsburgh and always wondered,
what exactly is that area?
A Fountain of Youth elicits ideas of perpetual childhood and adolescent vigor, but unfortunately, drinking from this fountain would likely elicit an upset stomach. The water that once trickled from the formation was found to be contaminated in the 1950s. It takes some hiking to reach this spot, but that's just fine with Trail Pittsburgh Vice President Mary Lynn Marzico, who expertly maneuvers through leaves and sticks, stepping on flat stones to cross the little stream.
You always wonder, too, what things were like back then, you know? This was built In 1938.
Top center of the structure, the words Fountain of Youth protrude from the middle. Marzico says the attraction was a big deal when it was first built.
People came from all over to see it. WPA, they were the ones that had built it. They wanted this to look like a Roman, Colosseum type of thing.
WPA was the Works Progress Administration, an agency set up as part of the New Deal after the Great Depression to help spur economic activity. Ornate water features like this were keystones of the region's parks and green spaces in the early 20th century.
The fountains in our parks are usually part of a larger design.
That's Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy's Susan Rademacher.
It's important to us to understand what was intended for people to experience. What was the purpose of this fountain?
The Parks Conservancy helps restore, maintain, and rebuild sites in Pittsburgh's park system, including its many fountains. Most of the city's parks were designed in the early 1900s as an escape for residents from the city's smog and smoke. Water features were designed as landmarks and focal points for visitors. From Highland Park's Entry Garden Fountain to Mellon Square's Uniform Water Steps, fountains can be a symbol of revitalization or create an atmosphere of relaxation with physiological benefits.
The ionized air that's a product of the water evaporation creates a more cooling environment and somehow has an elevating effect on your spirit, your sense of well-being.
But fountain maintenance can be expensive and time-consuming. Rademacher compares the condition of a fountain to a canary in a coal mine for public spaces.
When you see something that looks like it was a fountain and it's a flower bed, you know there's been a breakdown in institutional memory, in standards of care, in resources available.
Many of these fountains were not designed to recirculate water, which wasted a lot of H2O. When the historic fountains are restored, they're also replumbed. That was the case for the recent renovation of the Allegheny Commons Northeast Fountain on Pittsburgh's north side.
What a great day, huh?
Yeah.
Earlier this month, a crowd gathered for the fountain's dedication.
Very appropriate that it's a beautiful day for us to be in Allegheny Commons, the city's oldest park, and for such a great event.
According to City Public Works officials, this water feature is technically Pittsburgh's oldest, but with its restoration, it's also the youngest. In addition to this one, Public Works maintains 7 fountains. Money tossed in is donated to charity. The largest is in Schenley Plaza in Oakland, known as the Song to Nature. The smallest fountain is in the Walled Garden in Mellon Park. Pittsburgh's fountains are architecturally as diverse as the communities where they stand and continue to serve as gathering places for all residents. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Check out more of our good question stories and pose your own good question about Pittsburgh at WESA.FM. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A famed author and scholar based in Pittsburgh has unearthed disturbing and potentially explosive FBI allegations against Martin Luther King Jr. The accusations are based on the Bureau's extensive surveillance of the iconic civil rights leader. But some historians caution there are reasons to doubt the FBI claims. A warning for listeners, this story contains discussion of sexual violence. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports.
David J. Garrow is a historian specializing in the civil rights movement and formerly a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. His 1986 book, Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, won the Pulitzer Prize for biography. An earlier book explored how the FBI spied on King. A year ago, says Garrow, the National Archives quietly released, online, a vast trove of previously classified documents.
They are part of a huge document dump, only a very tiny percentage of which involves Dr. King. Most of the material is one angle or another having to do with the Kennedy assassination.
The dumped documents, there were some 54,000 web links, were uncatalogued, but Garrow dug in. Thanks to his experience with the FBI's filing system, he unearthed records of the Bureau's obsessive wiretapping of King's phones and bugging of his hotel rooms throughout the 1960s. Thursday, Garrow published a long article in the online and print editions of the British magazine Standpoint. Some of the information in The Troubling Legacy of Martin Luther King simply expands our knowledge of King's extramarital sexual activities that have been public knowledge for decades. For instance, Garrow says, about the number of women King had affairs with.
I always thought that there were probably 10 to 12 over the course of 4 or 5 years. This new material makes clear that the total is more like 40 to 45 different girlfriends.
But it's one alleged episode in a bugged hotel room that will strike many people as most shocking. Garrow found it in the files of FBI Assistant Director William C. Sullivan, a top deputy to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover.
What is new in the recently released documents is Assistant Director Sullivan's allegation that one of the women at this gathering was forcibly raped by one of King's ministerial friends as King looked on present in that same room.
It was January 5th, 1964, just months after King's I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington. King and a party of friends checked into Washington, D.C.'s Willard Hotel. An FBI surveillance summary also says that, quote, King looked on, laughed, and offered advice during the alleged rape. We can't hear these tapes or read the FBI's transcripts of them. Both are sealed by court order until 2027. We just have the summary. But if true, this incident would likely change many people's perception of King, who despite his flaws remains a social justice hero, one with his own national holiday. Beverly Gage is a history professor at Yale University who's writing a biography of J. Edgar Hoover.
I think it's remarkable research that in part affirms things that many people had already known in a general way. I certainly think the allegations about King watching a rape in progress and laughing about it are the most explosive.
The King estate did not return messages seeking comment for this story. But in the Me Too era especially, the alleged incident raises questions about the treatment of women by powerful men. Garrow also finds it disturbing that the FBI did nothing to halt this reported crime in progress. But did the incident actually happen as described? Gage cautions against drawing conclusions too quickly. To understand why, let's look at the evidence. The FBI summary describing the rape incident was typewritten, but those 7 words describing King's actions, King looked on, laughed, and offered advice, are handwritten in pencil. It's marginalia scrawled probably by Sullivan, the assistant director, says Garrow. That will strike many as suspicious. After all, Garrow's research is just the latest to detail that, as with many political activists, Hoover's FBI had it in for Martin Luther King.
The Bureau's hope was clearly to smear King, and in private, throughout official Washington, through church circles.
Sullivan was also behind the infamous suicide letter the FBI mailed King later that same year. The letter, accompanied by excerpts of FBI surveillance tapes, seems to suggest that King kill himself. It reads, quote, "There is but one way out for you." Gage, the Yale history professor, also notes that the words and sounds on the original tapes were themselves subject to interpretation. Remember, FBI agents were listening in from a nearby hotel room. They couldn't see anything that was happening. And the agents who transcribed the tapes were employees of an institution with its own sometimes questionable priorities, Gage says.
There is a whole wealth of interpretation that is, determined by the FBI's own subjective internal culture. It's determined by people's desires to tell their superiors what they want to hear, tell a figure like J. Edgar Hoover what he wants to hear.
For instance, in 1963, Sullivan told Hoover there was no evidence of communist influence in the civil rights movement, then quickly recanted after Hoover was angered by that conclusion. For some, such episodes create a deep skepticism about findings like Garrow's.
I wouldn't believe anything that's in some summaries done by disparate agencies, if they exist. Sometimes they're made up.
Mary Frances Berry is a University of Pennsylvania history professor and former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She also wrote a history of the commission, including FBI attempts to smear King to commission members.
I think that the lurid stories are probably exaggerated, and there's no reason for us to compromise his reputation and denounce him and take down his monument based on this kind of a story. Let's wait until we see the tapes. Let's wait till we hear them and then see what we think.
Garrow doubts agents preparing an internal FBI document would have flat out fabricated a story like this. Gage agrees.
I think it is unlikely that it was invented with no basis in reality.
Garu says it was very difficult to find a publisher for his article. He says he approached about 36 magazines and major newspapers, most in the U.S. and the U.K.
Some of which said, it's too long for us. Some of which said, oh, it's, you know, not a fit for us. A small number of forthright editors frankly said, we think this is too controversial, too revelatory for us.
He finally connected with Standpoint, a right-of-center British monthly that is pitching his article in a Me Too context as exposing the abuse of women. However, Garrow himself cautions that his findings do not close the book on what happened in a hotel room in January 1964.
I think only when the full materials are available, not just the summary samples, will there be possible a full historical reconsideration of to what degree does this undercut King's reputation.
Those tapes and transcripts will be available to the public in 2027, about 8 years from now. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Across the street from the Amtrak station, in the busiest part of downtown Harrisburg, stands the Rachel Carson State Office Building. Named for the famous environmentalist, it's home to the Commonwealth's Department of Environmental Protection. It's also home to some famous falcons. WESA's Katie Meyer reports Carson herself would probably be thrilled to know the birds are still around.
If you want to get a young peregrine falcon out of its nest without its parents beating you with their wings, you're going to need a broom.
There we go.
Hi, little guys. You ready for some fun? We're going to go for a little ride.
At least, that's the approach Art McMorris and several other state game commission biologists take. Every year, they put on harnesses, hard hats, and goggles and shimmy onto an office building ledge 15 stories up. Their goal is straightforward. Gently grab the nestlings and stick them in cardboard boxes so they can be banded and tracked. Well, that and avoiding the parents. The broom is the distraction, so they'll dive bomb it instead of the biologist's heads. It works most of the time.
We're not hurting their young, we're not hurting them, but of course they don't know that, so they will be flying around trying to whack us. It has happened. It has happened.
Okay. So what do we have? Oh, okay. I can tell just by looking that this is a female. She's a big girl.
McMorris is the Game Commission's Peregrine Falcon Program Coordinator. He's been banding and tracking the Rachel Carson Falcons since he started working at the agency in 2004. The birds have been here a little longer than that. A pair first landed on the 15th floor ledge in 1997, but didn't produce any chicks. Another pair gave the spot a shot 3 years later, and it has been occupied ever since. Falcons mate long-term and are strongly attached to their territory. Enthusiasts have gotten to know the birds' personalities like their old friends, thanks to a live stream from the cameras around the ledge. Thousands of people watch, and some go a step further.
For day shift, I'll get here very early in the morning, and then I usually have to come in and work a little bit. Then I might go in, or you know, I'll run out with the walkie-talkie if they call me, and then after work we'll be out there. And there's actually like a night shift then, and that's usually.
Renee Larry, a Department of Environmental Protection worker with a falcon tattoo on her chest, is one of Harrisburg's more active falcon watchers. Young urban falcons have high mortality rates, especially in the first few weeks they learn to fly. Larry and a small group of dedicated bird watchers try to keep them out of trouble.
Yeah, and I had to stop the cars and throw my jacket over it and get it and save it. That was like my most memorable one. Last year, Red Girl was on top of Strawberry Square there on the glass. We had to get her down.
Just Green different. Girl was the most memorable for
oh,
me.
Oh, on the train station.
Once they get through that touch-and-go period, the Rachel Carson Falcons scatter, often across the Northeast, Midwest, and Canada.
There's a bird that flies over these roofs that finds its prey not on the ground, but in the air. And it owes its success to its speed. In fact, it's said to be the fastest moving animal on Earth, the peregrine.
When they reach adulthood, peregrines thrive in cities. As of 2013, there were around 40 known nests in Pennsylvania, some on the cliffs falcons naturally favor, and many on buildings and bridges. But just a few decades ago, so many healthy pairs would have been unthinkable.
For this new insect destroyer contains a lot of DDT, not just a little. Its DDT content is even higher than government specifications.
That's because of DDT. The pesticide became ubiquitous in the 1940s. Planes sprayed it liberally over crops, and people doused their houses, pets, and children in it. And then, birds started dying. DDT wasn't good for adult animals, but in large predatory birds, its impact was especially profound when it came to eggs, weakening and cracking shells before they could hatch. According to the Game Commission, peregrine falcon nests disappeared from Pennsylvania around 1959. That's where the namesake of the Rachel Carson Building comes into all this. Biologist Rachel Carson's 1962 book, The Silent Spring, painted a picture of a world plagued by illness, where people and animals suddenly fall sick and where fish and birds slowly disappear. It became a bestseller and helped galvanize resistance to indiscriminate pesticide use. DDT is now heavily regulated, and Pennsylvania's peregrines are well on their way to recovery. Cindy Adams-Dunn, who heads the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, says it's a lesson for environmentalists working on the issues of today, like climate change.
That is, even though environmental issues may seem insurmountable, when people decide they're going to solve them and take proactive actions and have appropriate regulations and get themselves educated and involved, people can solve environmental problems.
I think. And now I'll show you one of the babies.
The department's trying to keep that lesson alive through the falcons on the Rachel Carson Building. After Art McMorris got this year's four chicks off the 15th floor ledge, he brought three downstairs for a Q&A with some fifth graders, many of whom are in their school's birding club.
What is the average lifespan of a falcon?
That's a very good question.
All of this year's falcon chicks are healthy. Soon they'll start learning to fly. And even though it's one of the more treacherous times in their lives, falcon watcher Sue Hannon says it's also the most exciting.
It's like, this is Christmas for me. I look forward to it that much.
The young falcons will hang around Harrisburg for a little while. And then if all goes well, they'll fly away. The newest representatives of a species that finally has a future. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The craft beer industry has been booming for several years, and almost every city can lay claim to being home to many of these breweries. But how many cities can claim that each of their neighborhoods will have their own distinctive brew? Scott Smith is the founder, owner, and head brewer at East End Brewing Company. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're creating a unique beer, one for each neighborhood, so that's 90 beers total?
90, 92, there's a little bit of a emerging controversy as to how many actual neighborhoods we have in the city. So we're hoping to offer a little education and maybe solve that mystery.
So city officials might say one thing, residents might say another?
Yeah, and you know, you look at a Wikipedia page, there's a bunch of sub-neighborhoods listed, and it gets more complicated than you would expect pretty quickly.
I have to bring up, Scott, that at least one longtime brewer might say, why 90, 92. We have one beer for the entire city, Iron City.
That's a lovely notion. Yeah. That's a very romantic idea.
Yes,
when you could order beer, walk into a place and order a beer.
And you'll get one choice.
Yeah, right.
Okay. But I just like your thoughts. Why, briefly, why do you think the craft industry has just taken off?
I think people are more excited about tasting something that has a flavor that is unique and distinct. The canvas that we paint on right now is broad right now. So we've got a lot of different flavors that we can bring to people. So we're bringing a lot of people into the beer world that just weren't drinking beer before.
Oh. So it's been about 15 years for your company?
Yep. We're 15 years in.
Has this idea of one per neighborhood been rolling around in your head for a long time? How'd you get the idea?
Yeah, this is something that's been... I've been percolating, or I should say brewing, with us for probably about 6 or 7 months, I had this notion of kind of thinking about, you know, hey, we're 15 years in at East End Brewing, thinking about our place in the local beer scene, what it means to be a local brewery, and what better way to connect with the people in the city than to take the beer to the neighborhoods.
So the first neighborhood beer debuts tomorrow. It's Allentown's. How did Allentown get that honor?
So we actually handpicked, handpicked Allentown because that's the home of our design partner, the guys at Commonwealth Press that we've been working with for so many years. And they really helped to put this together and handle the appearance of how all this entire series of beers will look.
All right. People are wondering, okay, get to it. So what type of beer are we talking about for Allentown?
So for the first one, the beer is an Imperial Shandy, which is a little bit of a made-up beer style. I guess they're all made up, really. They didn't fall out of the sky. So at Imperial, typically you think of a Shandy as being a lower alcohol beer. This one's about 7.5%.
All right. But it's you got some lemon flavoring like a Shandy,
yep.
But also some tea. How come?
Yeah. We added a tea aspect to it. It gives it a little bit more depth of flavor. So Shandy purists out there might have an issue with tea being in a Shandy. It's a little outside of the definition, but hopefully they'll be able to suffer through it.
Do you have an idea for flavorings for each neighborhood? For example, if I say Bloomfield, because of a significant Italian heritage, possibly right. a hint of red sauce, maybe oregano, yeah. Or Sinar maybe...
there certainly is that strong suggestion of, hey, should we program these beers to match a neighborhood? Is that something that we can pull off?
And the answer is?
And the answer is, if we want to produce 92 beers before we expire, that may not be something that we can execute. So we're actually going to leave that random. So the beer that gets paired with the neighborhood is going to be based on a random selection.
So maybe sauerkraut flavoring, a sour dunkel perhaps for Deutschland, not necessarily.
Well, it's an interesting notion. We certainly have done a few sour beers in our. We've got another one coming up here in a little bit. So.
Okay. So will Pittsburghers have a chance to at least make some suggestions?
We're certainly happy to take suggestions. And since we announced this, our social media feed has been overwhelmed with suggestions of beers and pairings in neighborhoods. Some of those we may be able to accommodate. Others it's fun to talk about. And we also are getting requests from Pittsburgh adjacent neighborhoods. People in Dormont are saying, hey, you're going to leave us out of the picture.
You know, we've got 130 communities in Allegheny County. You know?
We'll start with beer number 93. We'll start with Pittsburgh adjacent neighborhoods.
You know, Pittsburghers can be very, shall we say, protective of their neighborhood boundaries.
Absolutely.
So yeah. If I live in Southside Flats, am I allowed to sample the Allentown Shandy?
I think the bigger question is, if you're in the South Side, are you allowed to drink East End beer? I mean, that's the if you can say yes to that, then I guess you're allowed to have the Allentown Shandy as well. But the other part of this is we're going to be, wherever we can, releasing these beers in the neighborhoods. So it's an opportunity for Pittsburghers to explore their city, maybe see a side of it that they haven't seen before.
We have just a minute left. Will the beers be permanent addition to the lineup of East End Brewing, or are these temporary brews?
They are temporary. They are one and done. So if you like it, enjoy it while it's here, because it'll be gone soon.
How soon?
That's up to you.
Me?
How thirsty you are.
Me?
Exactly.
Okay. And so they're going to be available in the neighborhoods only, though?
At the brewery and at our tap room in the Strip District. And I should say our brewery is in the Larimer neighborhood, which will eventually come around in the rotation as well.
But you don't know when.
We don't know when. That's all.
You're picking it how?
Exactly. When we do a release, we pick the random. We pick a name out of a growler, a neighborhood name. Right out of the growler, and that's that determines what the next neighborhood's going to be.
We have just 20 seconds left. So do you know which neighborhood is next, and how long is the project going to take?
So the next neighborhood is going to be Overbrook, and we actually already have that beer in the tank. That's going to be a session-strength hazy hoppy beer. But realistically, this is going to be a few years pushing through this. We do about 35 beers a year, so if we double that, We're talking 3 years at least, and that's aggressive.
Scott Smith is the founder, owner, and head brewer at East End Brewing Company. Tomorrow he launches the first of the 92 neighborhood beers. You are here, neighborhood beer. Thanks so much for coming in, and cheers.
Thanks. Come see us in Allentown tomorrow.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, for decades, manufacturing was a mainstay of Western Pennsylvania's economy. Then it declined, but investment is growing again in manufacturing as it evolves. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskell. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.